Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Wednesday, January 13th. With me now on some of the legal aspects of impeachment, as well as the investigation and prosecution of some of the rioters themselves, is Cardozo Law School professor Jessica Roth. She is co-director of the Jacob Burns Center for Ethics in the Practice of Law. And previously, she was a federal prosecutor in the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of New York here in Manhattan for 7 years. Professor Roth, thank you so much for joining us on this momentous day.
It's my pleasure to join you. Thank you.
So people are saying if Trump is not convicted in the Senate of this charge of incitement to insurrection, he could potentially be charged with it in court criminally. Could you describe as a law professor what incitement to insurrection or to riot is in legal terms and what a prosecutor would need to prove to a jury to get a conviction on that?
So I think the most important thing to bear in mind is to pass First Amendment scrutiny. A prosecutor would have to prove that the defendant, whether it's the president of the United States or anyone else, engaged in speech and conduct that was both directed to inciting or producing imminent lawless action, and also was in fact likely to incite or produce such action. And that's pursuant to Supreme Court precedent. And so that's thinking about both the intent of the speaker and also the sort of objective reality, the context in terms of was it actually likely, given the words and the overall context, to actually incite or produce imminent lawless action. So that imminency is what's really quite critical.
So let me play a couple of clips that in this theoretical trial could become pieces of evidence and get your take as to whether they rise to that standard that you just described of willful incitement to riot. I want to go back to September 23rd. So this is during the campaign. This is just a 7-second clip. So listeners, pay attention. This will go by in a flash with a quick reporter's question and a quick response from Trump.
Will you commit to making sure that there is a peaceful transferal of power after the election?
Well, we're going to have to see what happens.
Well, he didn't say go and riot, but when asked whether he would commit to making sure there's a peaceful transition of power after the election, he hedged. His words were, well, we're going to have to see what happens. All right, 6 days later, September 29th, it's the presidential debate. The moderator, Chris Wallace from Fox News, asks him a question. This is a 22-second clip. We're going to hear Chris Wallace's question and the first part of President Trump's answer.
Will you urge your supporters to stay calm during this extended period, not to engage in any civil unrest? And will you pledge tonight that you will not declare victory until the election has been independently certified? President Trump, you go first.
I'm urging my supporters to go into the polls and watch very carefully.
All right. Two pieces of evidence in the hypothetical criminal trial of Donald Trump for incitement to insurrection. Professor Roth, do you have the goods?
I think you have very important evidence that you would put before the jury and that would be part of the overall case if you were going to charge incitement. As I said, it is the overall context that is critical. It is not a single statement. So what you have played so far, to my mind, is critical evidence. There's more, as you and I both know. And so I think all of it is very, very important so that the finder of fact would be considering all the relevant context.
So if you're looking for all the relevant context, then declining to tell people not to riot could be evidence of winking at them to riot.
It could be. It could be. It's an important part of the context. And we'd also want to think about what people were posting, announcing their plans to commit acts of violence and disruption of government processes, because I think that also is part of the context.
Here are two more. And these are not Trump himself, but things that were said presumably on his behalf at the rally that preceded the riot last Wednesday. This is his son, Donald Trump Jr. This is just 6 seconds.
We're coming for you, and we're going to have a good time doing it.
So we're coming for you are the key words there. And here's Rudy Giuliani, 16 seconds of him last Wednesday.
If we're wrong, we will be made fools of. But if we're right, a lot of them will go to jail. So let's have trial by combat.
Let's have trial by combat. Professor Roth, maybe that's the most explicit out of all the statements that we've played, maybe out of all the statements that exist. Could Rudy Giuliani be under criminal investigation for incitement to insurrection? And secondarily, does what Giuliani says on behalf of the president confer any legal liability on the president?
I think Rudy Giuliani could be investigated. I think anyone who is involved in speaking to the crowd in that context could well be under investigation. I think that whether or not his statements essentially can be attributed to the president, I think it depends in part on whether the president was hearing them and processing them. But again, all of this is very, very important to understand the context into which any subsequent statement was made, and whether the speaker of any subsequent statement would have appreciated the sort of the flammability of the situation. So everything you've played so far, to my mind, is part of that context. Obviously, the closer we are to the acts of violence in question, and Giuliani's statements at the rally are getting very, very close. Those build in their significance, again, because of the imminency standard. But all of it, everything you've played so far, is relevant context.
I think we have a legal question here from Peter in Manhattan. Peter, you're on WNYC with Cardozo Law Professor Jessica Roth. Hi.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. First-time caller and long-time listener. I've been listening for quite a while now since the election, and no one seems to have brought up the fact that he's a flight risk. I mean, he's got access to Trump is a flight risk, and he has access to Air Force One, and I think a lot of people know where he'd be welcomed with open arms and hailed as a hero.
He could bunk with Edward Snowden, who's hiding out in that same country. Peter, I take your point on flight risk. Of course, Professor Roth, he hasn't been charged with anything yet, and I guess that would come in to play in a bail hearing or whether somebody had to be held awaiting trial. But I'll entertain that hypothetical because we know that this incitement to insurrection aside, Trump might be charged here in New York with various crimes that the Manhattan DA and the New York State Attorney General are investigating, financial crimes and things like that. And maybe he really is a flight risk. So what do you think would happen in that case if he was indicted? Would he be put in jail so he didn't flee the country?
Well, that's something that the judge who would be presiding at the bail hearing would have to determine, taking into account all the facts and circumstances, including community ties, sort of financial wherewithal and contacts for the ability to flee. So that would be a fact-intensive inquiry. Certainly something judges do take into account is motivation to flee, as well as the sort of the opportunity and the means to do so. And that can be a factor of the product of the severity of the sentence, the potential sentence that somebody would face, as well as potentially sort of other considerations that might motivate them to flee.
Let's turn to the investigation and prosecution of the people involved physically in the riot. And Mark in Parsippany has a question about that, and then I have a question about that. Mark, you're on WNYC with law professor Jessica Roth. Hi.
Hi. Good morning, Brian. Thank you so much for your wonderful program. The work you and your team do is so important. Please, please keep it up.
Thank you.
My question to the professor is, given the fact that the storming of the Capitol would have to be classified as a violent felony, and given the fact that people died as a result, why have I not heard the term felony murder as a possible charge used? I've been watching for a week now, and this was one of my first thoughts once I heard people died. I would just like to know more about that.
Actually, I think the U.S. attorney for D.C. who held that news conference yesterday did cite felony murder. I think he used that exact term for some of the charges that could be forthcoming. Professor Roth, is that your understanding?
Yes, I think we are starting to hear people talk about that as a possibility, given that somebody did die. Multiple people died, but including one Capitol Police officer who was on duty at the time. And so I think felony murder is very much something that would be considered if murder charges are brought. Felony murder would be a possible theory for that.
What about terrorism charges? If terrorism is defined as an act of violence intended to influence a political outcome, well, that was terrorism to the layperson's eye. But the U.S. attorney in the news conference yesterday seemed to say he was not looking at that specific charge. Do you understand that?
Well, there's a number of other statutes that could be used. And so I think that probably the prosecutor is going to be exploring those first. I think there isn't one single law that makes domestic terrorism a crime. And so it may be that the better course is to use other statutes in prosecuting the conduct that did occur.
And during the siege, members of Congress had to huddle in rooms with each other, and the partisan divide over wearing masks for COVID protection didn't end even those extreme life and death circumstances. And from the reporting I've seen, even when Democrats asked Republicans to please wear a mask as they were huddling in close quarters, and many said no. Now at least three Democrats have come down with COVID, including Bonnie Watson Coleman of New Jersey, who's 75 years old. Does that leave anyone in legal jeopardy for, I don't know, reckless endangerment, or if someone were to die, God forbid, a manslaughter charge or anything like that?
Potentially, it could leave people in jeopardy for something. The most straightforward charge, I think, would be reckless endangerment, sort of recklessly, that is, aware of the risk, but disregarding the risk, exposing somebody to harm. And so if you could establish that the person who didn't wear the mask was aware of the risk and that it was a substantial and unjustifiable risk of transmission of something that could cause harm, that is a potential charge. And we're starting to see people talk about that sort of broadly about COVID exposure. The Attorney General in Massachusetts, Maura Healey, brought not a reckless endangerment charge, but a neglect charge against those who are operating a facility for veterans who were exposed to COVID. And so I think we're going to see that kind of charge perhaps being brought more broadly. And in the specific context you mentioned, that certainly is something that would be a potential line of investigation.
Just for a little bit of levity, Andy Borowitz, the New Yorker satirist, had a made-up headline this morning: shocking poll results. Most Americans say this is their favorite impeachment of Donald Trump. So there's the Borowitz take on today. Bridget, in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello, Bridget.
Thank you for taking my call. Hi, Brian. I have a question that has been in my mind. I would like to know, what is the FBI and the CIA going to do against the fascist movement? Basically, it's been growing and growing. They are going unpunished in Charlottesville when they killed. It's okay. I mean, I understand they're going to prosecute one guy who kills all the demonstrators, but this movement is really grave. So the same way they infiltrated back in the days, the left, the Black Panther and everything, which I think was wrong, by the way, because they were not committing this kind of crime. why can't they infiltrate these groups and stop them in their tracks?
Thank you for the big picture.
We're going to need to do something about that.
And hearing your voice, I guess I should have called you Brigitte, not Bridget. But Professor Roth, this is a great question for you as a former prosecutor in a U.S. attorney's office, because as I understand the role of federal law enforcement, it is not just to prosecute crimes after the fact, but certainly at the level of the FBI, for example, it's to try to do exactly what Brigitte was describing, which is to try to eradicate the violent potential of these white supremacist and other extremist movements. Where would your work have come into play? Where would the U.S. Attorney's Office in Manhattan's work have come into play, or sort of above that level, the FBI in Washington?
Well, the caller is absolutely right that prevention is a critical component of what law enforcement must do and is doing. And so part of that is monitoring social media, because a lot of these groups are quite active on social media, and just keeping track of what the plans are that are being put out there, really for anyone to see. And then also a more active role of trying to understand, including through infiltrating, through undercover agents, what's happening inside these organizations to get more detailed information that may not be available on social media. And so it's critical that law enforcement not be just sort of sitting on their heels waiting for something to happen, or wait until it's imminent to be playing an active role in an investigatory active capacity. Whether they're actually able to take an enforcement action against an individual or a group of individuals who are planning something, you know, is subject to some of the standards we were talking about earlier in terms of imminency when we're talking about pure speech. They can take action when particular activities are being planned and they get to a certain level of seriousness where there's the potential of bringing a conspiracy charge or an attempt charge. But so long as people are simply talking about what they'd like to do, an enforcement action typically is not available. That doesn't mean that law enforcement shouldn't be actively engaged, because they want to be in a position to take action as soon as it is legally permissible to prevent things like what happened last week from occurring.
We know from the FBI that there are ongoing threats possible. Do you see any relationship, and I realize this is hypothetical, but any relationship between the outcome of the impeachment vote this afternoon and the physical threat in the next few days?
That's hard for me to gauge as an outsider. I suspect and I hope that the law enforcement agencies involved are doing some of the things we just talked about in terms of actively monitoring social media, hopefully having a presence on the inside, speaking with people who are on the inside, so that they will have a better sense about what, if anything, is being planned in the days to come and what the reaction is to today's proceedings.
We've got a minute left in this portion of our special coverage, and then we'll throw it back to Washington. Professor Roth, what will you be listening for this afternoon? I understand it's just going to be 2 hours of floor debate before a vote. I don't know if Republicans are going to raise due process arguments, like can the president mount a reasonable defense? I realize this is not the trial, but the indictment or impeachment phase. But that or anything else, what will you be watching for this afternoon?
Well, it's important to remember that impeachment is a political process and not a criminal proceeding. So the standard for incitement that we were talking about that would apply in a criminal trial doesn't apply to the political process that is impeachment. But it will be interesting, nevertheless, to see if there are some people who are supporters of President Trump try to sort of conflate the two things and push that as a reason to oppose impeachment. But it's important, again, for listeners to bear in mind that legal standard doesn't apply or I should say that criminal legal standard doesn't apply to impeachment. And so I'll be interested to see the ways in which the members talk about what is impeachable in this context, and also whether they move away from a strict discussion of incitement and towards sort of the conduct in and of itself, and the overall context in which it occurred.
Jessica Roth, law professor at Cardozo, former federal prosecutor in the U.S. Attorney's Office in New York. Thank you so much for all the insight.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.